Good morning. It's Saturday, June 7th, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP in Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Shapiro, your host for Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear the first half of a conversation with Vermont poet and activist David Budbill. David Budbill was born in Ohio in 1940. He is the author of 7 books of poems, 8 plays, a novel, a collection of short stories, a picture book for children, dozens of essays, introductions, speeches, and book reviews, and the libretto for an opera. His play, Judavine, has been produced over 50 times in 24 states. His performance poetry is available on CD. He has been a commentator on National Public Radio's All Things Considered, and Garrison Keillor reads frequently from David's poems on the NPR program, The Writer's Almanac. David tours occasionally with avant-garde bassist and composer William Parker and drummer Hamid Drake. In 2003, the trio released Songs for a Suffering World, A Prayer for Peace, a protest against war. William Parker and David Budbill also released, in 1999, Zen Mountains, Zen Streets, a duet for poet and improvised bass, which is a 2-CD set of a live performance available on the Boxholder Records label. Among David Budbill's prizes and honors are a National Endowment for the Arts Playwriting Fellowship, a Guggenheim Fellowship in Poetry, and the Dorothy Canfield Fisher Award for Fiction. In 2002, the Vermont Arts Council gave David the Walter Cerf Award for Lifetime Achievement in the Arts. I interviewed David on April Fool's Day this year. I asked him to begin by reading a few poems about fools.
At the Imperial Tea Court. I'm going to California. When I get there, my friend Mark will take me to the Imperial Tea Court, so we can sip tea and look wise. Maybe you'll see us there, drinking tea and talking. Just two old fools having a good time. And old fool for Steve Stanfield, who's even older than I am. Sprained my back cutting firewood. Always a fool, now an old fool. On the road to Buddhahood. Ever plainer, ever simpler, ever more ordinary. My goal is to become a simpleton. And from what everybody tells me, I'm making real good progress. That's a few.
Thank you very much.
Sure.
And now, at the start of your book of poems, While We've Still Got Feet, you have an epigraph from Ryokan. Am I saying that right?
Yeah, that's fine.
How would you say it?
Well, I got a little story to tell. I was teaching a class at Johnson State, subbing for a friend, and there were some Japanese kids in the class, and I kept talking about Ryokan, Ryokan, Ryokan. And finally, this one Japanese girl raised her hand and said, "Why are you talking about B&Bs?" I said, "I'm not. I'm talking about the famous poet, Ryokan." She said, "Oh, you mean Ryokan." Because, you know, there's no R. And so Ryokan is the Japanese word for B&B, bed and breakfast.
Oh.
But if you say Ryokan, no English speaker will ever know what you're saying.
Right,
so.
Okay.
Yes, Ryokan's fine.
The epigraph reads, "Who says my poems are poems? My poems are not poems. Once you know my poems are not poems, then we can talk poetry."
Right.
What does that mean to you? Why did you put that in the beginning?
Well, Ryokan's one of my favorite poets, but also I think I'm always trying to write the anti-poem. I'm always trying to write the poem that isn't supposed to be a poem or isn't like poetry's supposed to be, or I'm always in rebellion against something. And so that's what drew me to that Ryokan quote. If you think my poems are poems, they're not poems. Don't tell me my poems are poems, et cetera, et cetera. Anyway.
Well, I figured we could talk poetry after I read that.
Right.
Um, You were born, I'm going to start, before we start talking about poetry, you were born in Ohio.
Right, Cleveland.
Cleveland. Do you have ties there still?
I only have one cousin left there. All of my other relatives are either dead or moved away somewhere else. Although I still do have emotional ties there. In fact, I just finished a play, quote unquote, a play this winter called A Song for My Father, a new play. And the whole thing takes place in Cleveland.
Mm.
It ends in a nursing home with the father's death. It's mostly about the father and the son. But the entire thing takes place in Cleveland. And it was quite an experience to remember all these specific locations in Cleveland and so forth. And, yeah, I still have a lot of emotional connections to that place.
Now, has that play been produced?
No. There's going to be some, probably a public reading of it this summer, maybe. No, it's brand new.
Will it be there?
No. I think the first reading of it will probably be here. Although I am in touch with a couple theaters in Cleveland, and I would love for it to be done there first. I would love it.
Your father was a streetcar driver.
He was.
Now, I didn't even know they had streetcars in Cleveland.
Well, they did.
Time.
Yeah.
Do you remember being on the streetcar?
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah. And, in fact, there's a scene in the play where the father is talking to the son about his holier-than-thou, pure, precious Vermont, where the son lives. And he points out that when he was a streetcar driver, there were 30 or 40 or 50 people per car, and they ran on electricity. So, I mean, he is always challenging the son about his sort of snooty feelings about the environment. But anyway, yeah, I remember my dad as a streetcar driver. I have a picture, actually, of him in his sort of his shirt and pants from his uniform and things like that. But yeah, I remember streetcars quite well. In fact, one of the things that you remember about them is when the car went down the street, when the tracks were embedded in the street and they were slippery, so your car would, it was a little bit like being in ruts in mud time around here.
Right.
The car would do funny things because where it's slipping on the tracks. Hmm. Especially intersections where there were lots of junctions and, you know, tracks going every which way.
Did they still have streetcars in Cleveland when you left? Or had they gotten...
No. I think probably the streetcars were gone by 1950.
Okay.
You know, I don't know, though. I don't know when they... they must have been. Well, I don't know.
Hmm.
That's a good question.
Your grandfather was a minister.
My mother's father, yeah.
Your mother's father.
Yeah.
Did you grow up being in church a lot?
Oh, yeah. I was in church twice a week, probably, at least.
In his church?
Well, if we lived near him, but mostly no.
Okay.
I come from way down deep in the Methodist Church in the Midwest. Yeah.
I read that you are, I know that you are very interested in Buddhism, but you've never given up Christianity, and you've sort of found your own way, and I'm curious if you could talk about that for a minute.
Well, everybody thinks I'm a Buddhist because of the way I write, and I keep saying I'm not. I'm a Taoist Buddhist Christian Taoist Buddhist Methodist from Ohio. I can't give up my heritage. I just can't do it. I don't feel like I want to. I mean, I know some people who are Buddhists not because they love Buddhism, but because they hate Christianity. They hate their past. And I think that's the wrong reason to become a Buddhist. And if you really look into Buddhism, it's full of as much hocus pocus and intrigue and corruption as any other religion. So I'm not going to jump out of the frying pan into the fire. So I suppose maybe you could consider that kind of being aloof, but I just don't feel any need to reject my Christian past in order to become a Buddhist or a Taoist or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We were talking about your father a minute ago. You have a poem in While We've Still Got Feet.
Right.
There's a number of poems about your father
right. In
here, but you have one. Is it all right if I read it?
No, go ahead.
Yeah. I've got my father's ashes on my desk. I've got my father's ashes on my desk in a little brass urn so I can look at them every morning before I start my work, so I can pick them up and shake them, hear what's left of him rattle around in there, the larger pieces of bone and tooth clacking against the side of that little brass urn. All those pictures of Christian or Buddhist monks, not just St. Jerome, staring at a human skull, looking deeply into those hollows where two eyes once were, those openings where a nose was, staring at what stained teeth remain. All those monks, over all those years, looking at the skull while it stares back and grins. That really struck me.
Yeah, go ahead.
I love that poem. It seems so comfortable.
Yeah.
With death.
Yeah.
And maybe even specifically with your father's death. I don't know enough about that to get into it. But I'm just curious if you can talk about that poem.
Well, first I want to prove that poets lie most of the time, but not always, because I guess you can't hear him talking about it.
I bet you can, actually.
Oh, look. Oh, my gosh. This is... Anyway, I'm shaking the urn, little brass urn.
So that is... I literally shouldn't have assumed it was autobiographical, but I thought it probably was.
Well, it is. And I have it on my desk. It appears that I write about death a lot, and there's a lot more poems about death in While We Still Got Feet than there were in Moment to Moment, and there's going to be even more poems about death in the new book, which I'm just putting together now. It's going to take forever. Than there were in While We Still Got Feet. It's an inevitable fact of life, and so I feel like the more you keep death in the front of your mind, the more you realize the more you think about your own mortality, the richer and more meaningful and more wonderful your life is. So it's not that I'm fixated on death, it's that in a way I'm fixated on life, and being able to really think about and confront and talk about your own death makes your own life more meaningful, I think. Mm-hmm. More pleasurable.
There's a tone within that poem also that I think dilutes the fear factor of death. You know,
yeah.
It's a very matter-of-fact tone. This is what awaits us all. And
Right.
How much of your poetry is autobiographical?
That's hard to say. I think of the poems. Oh boy, that's tough. Probably most of the poems. I've been thinking about that a lot lately because this new play called A Song for My Father is about a father and a son. And it started out about me and my father and our relationship. But especially with plays where you have characters acting something out, even though they start out autobiographical, by the time you're done, the people there in the play on the stage aren't, you know, they're not. It's not me and it's not my father. They're other people. So something that begins autobiographically may evolve, or usually does evolve, and in a theater I'd say always does evolve, into something other than autobiography.
And so the autobiographical point of inspiration evolves. And
yeah, it's a starting
changes.
Point. Yeah.
Do you think that it's a mistake to try and keep something specifically autobiographical?
I don't even try. I mean, I don't even think about it. I just do what needs to be done, and then it kind of happens on its own. With poems, it's different because the tone and the attitude and the approach of poems is a little different. Although, the play Judavine is based on a book of narrative poems.
Mm-hmm.
And I've actually... actually been this winter converting the play A Song for My Father into a book of narrative poems, or not narrative poems, but dialogue poems between the father and the son. So, but the characters in that book of poems are not, I mean, they start out autobiographical, but they end up being going somewhere else. So I don't think it's, I know there's a tradition in modern American poetry of autobiographical writing, but I just never have been interested in that.
Mm-hmm. You bring me to another question, and that is the idea of writing a collection. Do you start with like a collection in mind, or do you tend to write one or two or three poems and suddenly notice, so these are all sort of fitting around a certain theme?
Well, funny you should ask. I always want, I'm a storyteller. At heart, I'm just a storyteller, that's all. Whether it's on the stage or on the page, I'm still just telling stories. And I like for my books of poems to have beginnings, middles, and ends. I like them to take you somewhere on a journey. I like to be able to start a book of poems and bring the reader along to some place they weren't when they started. So the order of things is very important to me. And while we still got feet, it's pretty much seasonal. And then within that, there's themes, there's recurring motifs. But one of the traditions in ancient Chinese poetry is of organizing things seasonally, because the natural world was so important to them, and it's also so important to me because of where I live. But right now, I'm putting together this new book of poems, and I've got sections. I've got fall, winter, spring, summer, fall a second time. And then I've got sort of poems clustered around ambition, poems clustered around death and dying, poems clustered around what I call theory. I mean, sort of poems about Taoism or poetry or, you know, kind of philosophical poems. And right now, they're all in various sections. And in fact, last night I was printing out a big stack of stuff. And what I'll end up doing is, I don't know what'll happen, whether there'll be a season and then a cluster of poems on a theme and then another season and go around the year that way, or I just don't know. But ordering things, organizing them in some kind of, I was going to say rational way, thematic way, some way related to motif is really important to me.
Is that as much fun as the writing, just discovering the structure?
It is, it is. And one of the things that happened with Judivine, which was shocking to me, I mean, I wrote Judivine from 1969 to 1989, say, 20 years, and they came out in little chapbooks. And I tried to make the chapbooks have beginnings, middle, and ends, too. And then I started putting together the big Judivine book, and I didn't know, when I put the book together, I had no idea that for 20 years I was writing a novel or an epic poem. And that when I organized these things, I just realized, my God, you know, Antoine's a major character at the beginning, and then he kind of disappears, and then he shows back up at the end, you know, after he's been gone for years, and Antoine and David meet in the parking lot next to the McDonald's, you know, which didn't exist 20 years ago. What I'm saying is there's an organizing principle in every writer's, I don't even know whether it's the mind, but it's in there somewhere. And if you are open to it, it will organize things for you. And that's what happened with Judivine. I mean, I had no idea I was telling a story with a beginning, a middle, and an end. But I was. What I'm aware of, and the first time I discovered this was with putting together the big Judivine book. I'm aware that there is this, what I call the organizing principle. There's stuff going on inside of you, at least as a storyteller, that you have no idea about. But it's in there arranging things for you. And, I mean, that's amazing to me.
Right.
You know, that could happen like that.
That's part of the whole joy of of the discovery of writing anyway, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
Because it feels like it's happening to you sometimes.
Right, yeah.
The characters in Judevine, and in many of your poems, not just in Judevine, it seems like some of your poems are about complicated people living supposedly simple lives. That's my little phrase.
Yeah, that's very good. Yeah, I like that.
Is it hard to write those poems?
I don't know whether it's hard. As I'm fond of saying, I hear voices, and I write down what they say, those people say. You have to be careful about that. If you hear too many voices in the wrong way, you might end up in an institution.
Right, they'll take away your piece of paper.
Right. But mostly the writing I do comes from somewhere inside of me, and it starts with something that I have no control over. I have no idea where it comes from. And then after I've got a piece of it, then I can develop it. But the beginning is always kind of a mystery to me.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious how the real people in your surroundings reacted to Judevine. Were they... did they feel like they had been represented? Were there strong feelings?
Oh, God. It's interesting. Now it's been so long that people don't remember what happened or were here when it happened. When the first chapbook of poems came out, called The Chainsaw Dance, in 1977, and it was the first time anybody... I was known as a children's book author.
Right.
I'd written a picture book for kids called Christmas Tree Farm. I had written a collection of short stories for kids. I was about to publish a novel for kids. And so I was known as this nice children's book author. I was chairman of the local school board. And all of a sudden this book comes out, this chapbook, that's full of sex and politics. And there was a huge blow-up. My life was threatened. Our kid was told that our house is going to burn down.
Wow.
There was a big meeting at the school and a demand that I resign from the school board because I was a prevert, you know. Couldn't have anything like that. And, I mean, this was so... The National Endowment for the Arts Literature Program had civil rights lawyers ready, at the ready, in case they were needed to come up here to defend me and free speech and whatever. And it all kind of blew over. Well, it didn't blow over. I mean, there was a big meeting. There were 150 people there at the school. And what the amazing thing to me was that out of 150 people, there were 20 that were out to have my neck. And there were 130 there to defend me. Trouble is, if 20 people say to you, "You're the greatest thing since sliced bread," and someone says, "I hate you, I just hate you," you don't hear the sliced bread people. All you hear is the "I hate you." But we seriously just considered moving. It was really terrible. But we didn't move. I refused to resign. I'd been on the school board for 6 years by then, so I did not run again. But that was mostly... I probably would have been reelected.
Were people objecting more to the general content or to their own feelings that they had been portrayed?
Well, they both. They thought that I was ridiculing them. I thought I was writing love poems, and they thought I was ridiculing them. And they saw themselves in the characters. Oftentimes they were wrong about who they saw. And the interesting thing to me was that, well, there was one poem that caused an especially lot of trouble called Jimmy. If you went to the... People thought they knew who Jimmy was. If you went to someone who just knew about Jimmy, they'd say, "Oh, yeah, that's Jimmy. Perfect. Absolutely perfect." If you went to Jimmy's cousin, they'd say, "Well, yeah, I guess I can see that." If you went to Jimmy's brother, they'd say, "Absolutely not." So the closer you got to the character, the less people thought it was that person.
Hmm.
Which has to do with something. I don't know what. I mean, it has to do with the fact that what I was saying before about autobiography and about how things become something else. You can't, I mean, if there was a model for Jimmy, by the time Jimmy becomes a poem, it's not Jimmy anymore. And the other thing that's happened over the years is, someone thinks, well, that's Jimmy. Well, in 1977, by 87 or 97 or 2007, it's not Jimmy anymore. Because what happens on the page is stuck there. And it's frozen in time. Whereas any person who might have been the model for that, whether they were or not, changes constantly. So they keep changing and growing and dying, and the character in the book doesn't change at all.
Right. And the surroundings stay the same.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
They live in a timeless place.
Yeah.
Judavine was brought back to the Vermont stage in 2007 for the first time in a while.
That was to Lost Nation Theater in Montpelier.
Right. Yeah. Had it been performed in Vermont?
Oh, yeah.
Before?
Yeah, well, Judavine started, it wasn't even called Judavine, it was called Judavine of Vermont Anthology. It started at MacArthur Theater in Princeton, New Jersey in 1983. They did a staged reading in a reading series in like 80, 81. And then 83, 84, it had a run of like a month in the second stage at Princeton University. In a little theater on team that was about 150 people. And then it started, and then about two or three years later, a guy, a director here in Vermont named Robert Ringer, Bob Ringer, started a theater called Vermont Stage, or, well, no, Vermont Repertory Theater, right, at 40th and Allen, in an old church. And Judavine played there about in like their second or third season. It was a big hit.
That's when Rusty DeWeese made his name, as Antoine.
That's right.
Yeah.
Rusty became known to Vermonters all of a sudden as Antoine, which is the model, of course, for a lot of the stuff he's doing now with the Logger. And Rusty was in. There were numerous revivals of it at Vermont Repertory Theater. Rusty was in them all. And then, but by about 1990, I think, it was gone from Vermont. And it's been done, I think, 58 times in 26 states. But it had never been back in Vermont for, I think it was 17 years. So this production last spring was, I welcomed it because it was being done everywhere in America but here, you know, which was frustrating to me. And then Lost Nation's going to bring it, revive it this fall in September for 3 weeks in Montpelier. And then they're going to go on the road with it in Brattleboro and Rutland and Bellows Falls and Londonville and about three or four places around the state.
I hope you enjoyed the first half of that conversation with David Budbill. Next Saturday, tune in at 9 a.m., half an hour early, if you'd like to hear a rerun of this show. And then stay tuned for the second half of the interview in the normal time slot, 9:30. Here's the Bookworm's calendar for the coming week. This morning at 11 a.m., so in just about an hour, Tanya Lee Stone will be at the Flying Pig Bookstore in Shelburne to talk about her children's book, Elizabeth Leads the Way, Elizabeth Cady Stanton and the Right to Vote. The Green Mountain Global Forum presents environmental activist Diane Wilson, author of Unreasonable Women, at the Big Picture Theater in Waitsfield on Sunday, June 8th at 7 p.m. On Thursday, June 12th at 7 p.m., the One World Library Project will host a talk titled Winds of Change, Past and Present in Alaska's Aleutian Islands by artist, author, and teacher Ray Hudson at the Lawrence Memorial Library in Bristol. Also in Bristol, the Inn at Baldwin Creek and Mary's Restaurant present cookbook author, food journalist, and Vermont Life food editor Maria Lisa Calta of Calais on Friday, June 13th at 6:15 p.m. Calta will speak about Vermont's culinary history. This dinner and talk require pre-registration through the Inn at Baldwin Creek. If you're interested in sharing Write the Book with out-of-town friends, let them know they can stream it live every Saturday morning at www.theradiator.org. Archived episodes of Write the Book are also available on iTunes as free podcasts. If you have comments about the show or events for next week's Bookworms calendar, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. This has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM WOMMLP in Burlington, Vermont.